Let your hair down.
Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is made for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. These are the stories we have for you on today's program. First, the education report. Dan Friedel talks about a proposed law that could make it easier for foreign STEM students to stay and work in the United States. Susan Shand will talk about poverty in China. I will return with this week's words and their stories. We will finish our 30 minutes together with The Making of a Nation, our ongoing U.S. history program. But first, the education report.
On his first day in office, President Joe Biden said he was sending a bill to Congress called the U.S. Citizenship Act of 2021. The aim of the bill is to provide ways to give more immigrants the chance to gain citizenship. The bill also proposes to make it easier for graduates of U.S. universities with advanced STEM degrees to stay in the United States. STEM is a term that describes the fields of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. The bill was introduced in the U.S. House of Representatives on February 18th and will have to be debated in the House and the Senate. However, many of the ideas in the bill are in line with what many university officials want to see. Stephen Titesworth is a professor and the director of graduate studies for the physics department at Duke University in North Carolina. Titesworth said Duke has about 80 graduate students in physics this year. He said his department has not seen less interest in its program over the last few years. He thinks this is because Duke is a private university and does not receive a significant amount of state funding for its programs. But he said his students are worried that they will not be able to stay in the U.S. once they graduate. They currently live in the U.S. with student visas. Titesworth thinks it is important for the U.S. government to make clear, consistent policy decisions related to foreign students being able to work in the country.
The big issue is just greater clarity, consistency, and consistency from year to year, not, you know, having policies change on a dime. I think consistency and predictability are really going to be critical so that our students can focus on doing great research.
Many foreign graduate students who were accepted to U.S. universities for the 2020-2021 academic year chose not to come. That was because of the coronavirus health crisis. However, the number of foreign graduate students had already been decreasing. Some experts who follow higher education say doctoral programs in other countries, like Great Britain and Australia, are getting more competitive with American ones. Earlier this year, the American Council on Education wrote a guide for how American universities should think about foreign students. It offered ideas to deal with what it described as falling numbers of international students starting in 2015. Titesworth, the Duke professor, said if new foreign worker rules are put into place, it would be good news for higher education in the U.S. He added that it would also be good news for students who are worried about coming to the U.S. to study.
So I think it's very significant, obviously. Certainly for the many students who will choose to stay in the U.S. and have great careers here. But even for those who go elsewhere, it shows that the welcome mat is out and a spirit of collaboration. So I think it's really a win-win situation from that point of view.
Even if the universities do not get exactly what they want, the legislation seems to support their goals. During his presidential campaign, Biden himself said that he did not want to prevent some skilled young people from staying in the U.S. if they can provide something good for the world economy. I'm Dan Friedel.
Now let's hear from Susan Shand.
China opened the yearly meeting of its top legislative advisory body, the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, on Thursday. The CPPCC leader praised President Xi Jinping's government's COVID-19 response and reported, in his words, an all-round victory in China's fight against poverty. Last week, President Xi made similar comments in a ceremony celebrating the progress on poverty reduction. He declared extreme poverty had been ended in China. All 98.99 million people who are the poor rural population have been taken out of poverty, he said. In 2012, Xi began a plan that has helped China go beyond the World Bank's 2030 target for ending extreme poverty. Official media broadcast the ceremony last week to millions of people. Xi told citizens that the government had spent about $246 billion to fight poverty over the last 8 years. Xi said these people no longer need to worry about being able to buy food and clothes. He also said the government will guarantee health care, housing, and education. The People's Daily, official newspaper of the Chinese Communist Party, CCP, called the ending of poverty historic. Just this past Sunday, China released what it calls the number one policy document. It promised to keep fighting poverty while changing the plan to what China calls rural revitalization. Experts quoted by the state-owned Chinese newspaper, The Global Times, said the new policy will work to help communities in rural areas need less government assistance. This would be done by creating many new jobs in large infrastructure projects, the experts added. However, in defining poverty, China continues to use the World Bank's measure for establishing the world's poorest countries. But the World Bank considers China among upper middle earning economies. Also, China defines a person who lives in rural poverty as someone who lives on $1.69 each day, reports Reuters. The World Bank defines it as someone who lives on $1.90 each day. In looking at the Chinese economy, Brookings Institution economist Dermot Gill wrote that measuring progress using the official poverty lines of the world's poorest countries is the very definition of underachievement. Xi and the official media remained largely silent about more than 40 years of market-style economic reforms that began with opening China to foreign investment after the Cultural Revolution. Xi's declaration of the end of poverty in China conflicted with a statement by Chinese Premier Li Keqiang last May. There are over 600 million people whose monthly income is barely $140, not enough to rent a room in Chinese cities, he said at his yearly press conference. I'm Susan Shand.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we explore words and expressions in American English. Today, we talk about a common idiom from sports, to raise the bar. To raise the bar means to set a high standard and to raise expectations. It can also mean to set higher goals. You can raise the bar for yourself or for others. But we often use this expression when someone's performance is much better than others. When you raise the bar, you increase the expectations of people who have settled into a way of doing things. For example, let's say a person is really good at playing a video game. If he joins a team game, his skill level will raise the bar. The other players will have to play better to come up to the new level of competition. When you use the expression, you can sometimes put a word before bar. This will describe the situation better. For example, when a new intern started at VOA Learning English for his fall semester, he would wear a suit during online video meetings. Most of us, who had been working at home for many months, did not dress up. We looked presentable, but our clothes were not formal. So he really raised the clothing bar for our weekly meetings. Here is another example. Let's say you are invited to go to a potluck party. At a potluck party, everyone is supposed to bring one thing to drink or eat. You make a very tasty cake with four layers and fancy decorations. The host might say, "Wow, you really raised the potluck bar for the rest of the people at the party." Word experts say people began using the idiom raise the bar around the turn of the 20th century. It comes from the sport of track and field, specifically the high jump and the pole vault events. These events involve raising a bar incrementally or a little at a time, to see how high the athletes can jump or vault over a bar. Now, let's hear these two friends use the expression together.
How's the new job going?
Great. I go into the office an hour early every day and stay late almost every night. Plus, I get all my work done days ahead of my deadlines.
Aren't you worried that you might be raising the bar a bit too high?
No way! If other people can't perform as well, that's good for me, right?
Well, you don't want to raise the bar so high that one day you have trouble getting over it.
You know, that's a really good point. I never thought of it like that.
That's what friends are for.
Maybe I'll ease up a little bit.
Good idea.
And that brings us to the end of this week's Words and Their Stories. When it comes to teaching American English, we hope we raise the bar just a little bit higher for English learners. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember.
I want to say to you that for the next 4 years, there'll be a Democrat in the White House and you're looking at him.
Presidential elections are exciting events in American politics. Few elections for the White House have been as exciting as the one in 1948. And few have had such surprising results.
This is NBC Television.
We have obtained the results from the state of Ohio, which assures victory for President Truman and Senator Barkley. With Ohio's 25 electoral votes, President Truman and Senator Barkley will have a total of 266 votes in the Electoral College. This is the minimum figure necessary for victory.
Four candidates were nominated for president in the 1948 election. One was the man already in the White House, the candidate of the Democratic Party, President Harry S. Truman. Truman had been the party's vice presidential candidate with Franklin Roosevelt in 1944. When Roosevelt died a year later, Truman became president. He was the one who made the decision to drop atomic bombs on Japan to end World War II. But Truman did not do well during his first few months in office. He made several serious mistakes. He had trouble with the economy and organized labor. His party lost control of the Senate and the House of Representatives in the congressional elections of 1946. Most Americans had little faith in Truman's ability as a leader. They expected that he would lose the presidential election in 1948 if he chose to be a candidate. President Truman did choose to run. He took several strong steps to show his leadership in the months following the Democratic defeat in the congressional elections. Truman called on Congress to pass a number of laws to help black people. He took firm actions in his foreign policy toward the Soviet Union. These included the Marshall Plan and the Berlin Airlift, as we discussed in our last two programs. And he began to speak out with much more strength to the American people. Truman succeeded in winning the presidential nomination of the Democratic Party. He chose Alban Barkley, a senator from Alabama, for vice president. Senator Barkley and I will win this election and make these Republicans like it. Don't you forget that, Truman declared in accepting the nomination. The Republicans nominated New York State Governor Thomas Dewey. Dewey was a wise and courageous man. He was also very serious. Truman campaigned by telling the voters that Dewey did not understand the needs of the average American. He called Dewey a candidate of rich people. One day, Dewey got angry at a railroad engineer because his campaign train was late for a speech. Truman said this proved that Dewey did not understand the problems of railroad engineers and other working Americans. He tried to make the election a choice between hard-working Democrats and rich Republicans. Two other men also were candidates for the presidency. Both were from newly created parties. One was Strom Thurmond from South Carolina. He was a candidate of the States' Rights Democratic Party, also known as the Dixiecrat Party. Most of his supporters were white people from the southeastern part of the country. They opposed giving full rights to black people. The other candidate was Henry Wallace of the Progressive Party. His supporters believed that Truman had turned away from the progressive ideas of Franklin Roosevelt. Both Thurmond and Wallace had broken away from the Democratic Party. Most political experts believed these two candidates would take votes away from President Truman. They believed the Republican Dewey would surely win the election. President Truman did not have strong public support. But Harry Truman was a fighter. He did not believe the election was lost. He took his campaign to the American people.
On election day, the president, the Congress, the governor, the mayor, all cease as the government. You are the government, because then you decide what sort of a government you want. And when you do like you did in 1946, when two-thirds of you stayed home, you get just what you deserve. You got that good-for-nothing 80th Congress.
He said he had always campaigned by going around, meeting, and talking to people. Running for president was no different, he said. He just got on a train and started across the country to tell people what was going on. He wanted to talk to them face to face. When you stand there in front of them and talk to them, he said, the people can tell whether you are telling them the facts or not.
If you give the Republicans complete control of this government, you might just as well turn it over to the special interests, and we'll start on a boom and bust cycle and try to go through just what we did in the 20s and end up with a crash, which in the long run will do nobody any good but the communists.
Truman campaigned with great energy. He made hundreds of speeches as his train crossed the country. It became known as the Whistle Stop Campaign because it stopped at some of the smallest towns and villages in the country. Truman gave speeches from the back of his campaign train, the Ferdinand Magellan. He spoke to farmers in Iowa. He visited a children's home in Texas. And he discussed issues with small groups of people who came to visit his train when it stopped in rural areas of Montana and Idaho. Dewey and the Republicans laughed at Truman's campaign. They said it showed that Truman needed votes so badly that he had to spend his time looking for them in small villages. Truman said the criticism proved that Republicans did not care for the average American. Dewey also campaigned across the country by train, but he showed little of the fire and emotion in his speeches that made Truman's campaign so exciting. Dewey's speeches were safe. One reporter wrote that Dewey was acting like a man who had already been elected and was only passing time waiting to take office. Dewey had good reasons to feel so sure of being elected. Almost every political expert in the country said Truman had no chance of winning. The Wall Street Journal, for example, printed a story about what Dewey would do in the White House after the election. And the New York Times said that Dewey would win the election by a large majority. Truman refused to accept those views. Instead, he spoke with more and more emotion against Dewey. Most Americans still believed that Truman would lose, but they liked his courage in fighting until the end. One supporter shouted, "Give 'em hell, Harry," them being the Republicans. Soon, supporters across the country were shouting, "Give 'em hell, Harry." Truman made special appeals to working people, Jews, blacks, Catholics, and other traditional supporters of the Democratic Party. In his final radio speech before the election, he promised to work for peace and a government that would help all people. Then he went to his home in the state of Missouri to wait with the rest of the country for the election results. Republicans across the country greeted Election Day happily. They were sure that this was the day that the people would choose to send a Republican back to the White House after 16 years. Some of the early voting results from the northeastern states showed Truman winning. But few Republicans worried. They were sure Dewey would be the winner when all the votes were counted. The Chicago Tribune was also sure who the next president would be, declaring in a huge headline, "Dewey defeats Truman." But the newspaper was wrong. Everyone was wrong. Everyone, that is, except Harry Truman and the Americans who gave him their votes. Truman went to bed on election night before all the votes were counted. He told his assistant that he would win. He awoke early the next morning to learn that he was right. Not only did he defeat Dewey, as he thought he would, but he won by a good number of votes. And he helped many Democratic congressional candidates win as well. The Democrats captured both houses of Congress. After the results were announced, as heard in this old recording, Truman showed his sense of humor by joking about the predictions of his defeat.
I had on the National Broadcasting Company, Kelton Barn was saying, "While the president is a million votes ahead in the popular vote, we have yet to hear from the president." Very sure that when the country vote comes in, Mr. Truman will be defeated by an overwhelming majority." And I went back to bed and went to sleep.
Harry Truman would make many difficult decisions as America moved into the second half of the 20th century. Truman would send American troops to help the United Nations defend South Korea against aggression from the North. He would join other Western leaders in establishing a new alliance, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. They established NATO to provide for the joint defense of Europe and North America. Truman and later presidents would make decisions to send large amounts of economic and military aid to countries around the world. Many of these decisions were necessary because of America's new responsibilities after World War II as leader of the Western world.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Ana Mateo.